So I've been working basically on a single theme now, certainly since the beginning of the year, starting with the two wings of enlightenment and so on and so forth. And where we got to at our last meeting was talking about nouns and verbs, right, and about how we see processes as if they were solid things. And so that's my little bit of a recap, and that's where I'll pick up from. And what I'll probably want to talk about for at least the next couple of our sessions is to continue with this theme, but in the context of what is a person, what is the I, what is a self, these kinds of things. Which is really, I think, is the central concept to come to understand in Buddhism is what is the nature of I, or what is the nature of the self. And that, I mean, it's not the only thing, of course, but it's like a pivot or a fulcrum, or the, from my point of view anyway, or maybe it's the axle on which everything turns. And if you get it right, other things fall into place. And if you can't get it right, things don't fall into place. Now, maybe I say that because it's the sort of thing that's been of interest to me since I was in college. Or maybe I say that because it's true. I don't know. Take it. Who knows? So the Buddhist tradition is not really organized in terms of, I'm not getting off the subject, the Buddhist tradition is not really organized in terms of there being authorities. I mean, it's not like, you know, in the Catholic Church there's a Pope and there are cardinals and there's established theology and all that kind of stuff. In the Buddhist tradition there are a lot of scriptures and great teachers and sages and authoritative commentators and so on and so forth. But they mostly disagree with each other about some pretty important stuff. And they agree with each other about some pretty important stuff. But the point is that, going right back to the time of the Buddha, he said, you know, the real authority is yourself, within yourself, and no place else. Not me, not anything else. Now, of course, the problem with that kind of a statement is that there's so many different people who are at different stages of human development that, you know, it becomes a question of where is the authority really? Because, I mean, if we only listen to ourselves, then basically we're stuck with our own limitations, right? So we know we have to listen to somebody who has limitations that are at least larger than ours if we're going to break out of our own limitations. So it does create certain kinds of issues. And shortly after the Buddha's death, all his disciples got together and said, well, we're going to have to keep track of what he had to say here, and we don't want to make mistakes about this. So let's all sit down and because people had good memories back then, let's all, you know, repeat all the stuff we remember Shakyamuni having said. And if we can all remember that he said that sort of thing, then it must have been the case that he said it, and so now we'll remember that that's authoritative. But if only Ananda remembers it, nobody else can remember ever having heard that, then maybe Ananda's memory is not so good and he misunderstood or something like that, and we won't consider that authoritative. Now the problem with that, of course, is that the Buddha may have said something to Ananda that Ananda needed to hear that nobody else needed to hear. But anyhow, that's pretty much what they did. But again, as a consequence of that, within about 300 or 400 years of the Buddha's death, there were someplace between 12 and 20 different established schools of Buddhist thought that differed with each other on some of the fundamental ideas. And they more or less all got along, but they said, no, we're right, you're wrong, each to all the others. Which created kind of a difficult situation. But I mean, in fairness, at least to the Buddhist tradition, they didn't go around slaughtering each other because you guys are wrong and we're right. But it did create a certain kind of a chaos in a way. Now, as it turns out, most of those traditions didn't survive in the long term anyway, for various reasons. And two main kind of lineages or traditions did survive, which we refer to now as either the Hinayana and the Mahayana, which means the individual vehicle and universal vehicle, or maybe the Theravada, because one of the terms for Hinayana is small vehicle and Mahayana is large, which is kind of insulting. So we can go with Theravada, which is the tradition of the elders, and Mahayana, which is the tradition of the great vehicle or the all-inclusive vehicle or something like that. And one of the reasons that these two traditions are kind of a convenient way to divide this up, because of their scope in regards to settling sort of a key problem. And what that is that the later scholars in Buddhism looked at this, all these different scriptures which sometimes seem contradictory, and the different traditions which sometimes seem contradictory. And they looked at all of it and they said, well, what we think is going on here is that the Buddha taught differently to different people based upon their own their capacity to understand. We wouldn't explain nuclear physics in the same way to, well, maybe that's a bad, we wouldn't explain the basics of physics to an 8-year-old in the same way we would to a college student. I mean, that we take that for granted, you know. So in the same way, you know, the Buddha would teach the essentials of something that's at least as complicated as nuclear physics to people in a different way based upon what their capacity was for understanding. I mean, you know, the way the Buddha would teach a robber on the highway, which he did, is not the way he's going to teach his own monks, and certainly would not be the kind of teaching he would give to the king of the local, you know, the local kingdom. That all the needs of these people and their ability to understand, the way they would hear things and interpret things, would have to be different. So the later scholars looked at the whole tradition and they said, well, basically, what we have here is we have different teachings for different kinds of people on a kind of developmental or, if you will, evolutionary scale. And some teachings are good for people at one level of development, and other teachings are good for people in the middle and more advanced and so on and so forth. And so they took this whole complex of different things and they organized them in this kind of systematic fashion. And they said that was, you know, this teaching is for this kind of person and this teaching is for that kind of person. But their sort system was pretty sophisticated. I mean, they recognized that some people were realists, that their starting position is that everything is concrete and material, and, you know, if I can't see it, I don't want to believe it, and that there's a certain kind of teaching that's appropriate for them. But other people are very in the mode of idealist and philosophical idealist, not like moral idealist. And their tendency is to understand that everything is a product of mind, and therefore how you teach them is different than how you would teach a realist. And so they organized things in that way. But one of the main ways in which they organized all this, and this really is relevant to what I'm continuing to talk about, one of the main ways they organized this was on the basis of the scope of what needs to be refuted. Now, this is sort of a strange concept. But the idea is that Buddhism is a very kind of analytic tradition. It very greatly stresses every individual reflecting on their own experience and understanding their own experience. So in looking at your own experience, from the way they understand the process, is one of the things that you want to do is you want to identify things that are to be refuted, which is wrong notions. But you also want to identify things that are not to be refuted because they're correct notions. That you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You want to throw the bathwater out, but leave the baby alone. I mean, to use that kind of example. And so a key issue is, if you're looking at the self or the I, the subjective person, the question is, what's to be refuted in your understanding of the self, and what is not to be refuted in your understanding of the self? Now, you've probably heard that people have talked about this idea of egolessness. You know, I mean, back in the 60s and the 70s, there was a lot of talk about becoming egoless. Now, from the Buddhist perspective, that would be an example, that concept of egolessness would be an example of refuting what is not to be refuted. Because the basic Buddhist view is it's not possible to be totally without a sense of I or self. That you don't even want to try. It's not only do you not want to try, it's not even possible. And yet there are all these people walking around saying, well, I'm going to practice, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism, or whatever, because I want to become egoless. And, you know, the Tibetans would look at that and say, what are you talking about? You know, it's like, how can you be egoless? I mean, somebody's got to drive the car. Who's frying the eggs in the morning? You know, I mean, there's somebody there. And people, you know, so it's really confusing. Now part of that has to do with translation errors. So I know I'm sounding pretty scholarly tonight, but I can't help it. These things are relevant. I mean, in the East Asian world, when they talked about self and they refuted self, they were refuting, the object of refutation was something which was to be refuted, which is a certain type of self. But the way they did it, because of the nature of Chinese, was they appended the word, I don't know what the Chinese word is, but no to that. So they talked about no self. Now, that meant they were refuting a certain type of self. It didn't mean they were refuting all self. But that managed to make its way into English eventually and went out into the common world. And, oh, no self. That means there's no self. That's what this is about, getting to the place where there's no self. Well, no, that's not really what they intended to be. You know, I mean, maybe you can get to the place where there's no self. I mean, that might be, you know, a place that you get to, at least from your own subjective experience, after a bottle of vodka or something like that. But, you know, it's kind of, it doesn't really get at what the Buddhist intention was. I mean, I use that example, and it sounds funny, but there was actually, in the early 9th century in Tibet, there was a strong influx of both Indian and Chinese teachers, and they had to kind of sort out the differences between these traditions. And one of the Indian masters critiqued a certain teaching that one of the Zen teachers presented by saying, well, if the solution to the problem is simply to stop thinking, then why are you bothering to meditate? You might as well just get drunk and that'll solve the problem. I mean, this is actually in, you know, the scholarly sources. And of course, it doesn't solve the problem because you sober up. And even temporarily, it doesn't really solve the problem. I mean, he was just sort of, you know, pushing a point. Anyway, back to the main thing. So the main thing in understanding I and self is determining what is to be refuted and what is not to be refuted. And what that means is that there is an aspect, if you will, of the self or way of being, a subjective way of being, which we understand and we understand incorrectly, and there's a subjective way of being which we understand correctly, even right now. And so the question is, how do we get rid of what we need to get rid of and not get rid of what we don't need to get rid of? And so that becomes sort of the key problem. And it's not that easy because we don't recognize a difference. In our experience, I'm just me. It's not like I have aspects that are real and unreal. I'm just me. And it's very hard to figure out what's real and what's unreal. And as a matter of fact, even the idea that there might be some part of me that's not real is kind of a radical notion. I mean, because sort of the basic way we go about things is, well, of course, I'm just me. I mean, isn't that obvious? You're just you. And that's pretty straightforward. There's nothing unusual about that, right? Well, in the Buddhist view, wrong. Because built into that subjective notion of I'm just me, and everybody knows what that is, and ain't that just fine, built into that is the problem, which has thrown us in the pickle we're all in, to use the language I used 2 weeks ago. The problem which has thrown us in the pickle we're in is we're misunderstanding certain things. And because we're misunderstanding certain things, we live in a world in a way which produces negative outcomes. You know, I mean, if you were fixing your car, if you had a Toyota, right, and you're having problems with your engine. And he said, well, that's no problem. I'm going to just use this owner's manual here and I'll fix my Toyota engine. But it was a Chevy owner's manual. You really wouldn't expect to have a very good outcome of trying to tune that engine, for example. I mean, we understand that when it comes to mechanics, but we don't really get it in respect to other kinds of things. And, you know, it's kind of like we're living in a world where we need to tune our Toyota engine, but most of us are walking around with a Chevy manual, and so we don't have a good outcome. And we keep wondering why things don't work out. Well, we've got the wrong manual, so how do you get the right manual? That is knowing what to refute and what not to refute. So what's right to, what is it to be refuted and what is not to be refuted? And the answer to that, actually, I gave you 2 weeks ago. The answer to that is that our tendency is to view things as permanent rather than impermanent, partless rather than made up of parts, independent rather than dependent, and fully described by the ideas we have about things rather than those ideas are mere notions that we impute or place on things. So I'll go back through these things one at a time, because there are three things about I or about anything else in the world which are to be refuted. And by the way, when I talked about these different traditions that existed a few hundred years after the Buddha's time that resolved themselves down to finally two, the Theravada and the Mahayana, one of the ways of understanding the difference between those two traditions is what they decide to refute, what they decide not to refute. Okay, so the Hinayana tradition refutes things about the person, but doesn't refute a lot of things about the physical world. And the Mahayana tradition says that what we refute about the person, similarly we refute about the world. That, although it sounds strange, that what we refute about the personal self is also what we refute about the self of physical things. And the Hinayana tradition is, I know this is strange, I'll come back to it. The Hinayana tradition is, we don't refute anything more than the self of persons because we don't believe that the physical world is a world of selves. And the thing that it throws us with that language is self refers to any substantial entity or thing. Right? So when you think about what I am, what is myself, you know, you think I am a thing, I am an entity. I mean, it might be a little homunculus inside yourself or a little spirit or a soul or an ego, to use our language, but we think of ourselves as a thing, an entity. And we tend to think of the world as made up of things and entities. And so the Mahayana view is that I, me, the subjective self, is only a special case of the general way we think about everything. And the Hinayana view is a little different, that that's not the case, that there is a difference, and we don't worry about refuting that stuff out there. Okay, so what are the three things that are to be rejected? They are that anything is a whole and is not made up out of parts. So we've talked about this before. Anything is that anything, whether it's subjective I or the physical world, is a whole and is not made up out of parts. The sense of wholeness is rejected. Now, it doesn't mean, well, I'll come back to that. Okay. So the sense of wholeness is rejected in respect to the idea that there's a whole without parts. What's rejected is the idea that there's a whole without parts. What's not rejected is the idea that there's a whole with parts. You see the distinction here? Mm-hmm. You know, this is about discerning what's to be rejected and what's not to be rejected. Right? Mm-hmm. Because there are obviously whole entities. Here's a tape recorder. an integrated circuit recorder. We don't have tape recorders anymore. Here's an integrated circuit recorder. If I look at it, it's obviously made up out of parts. And yet, I do experience it as a whole entity, and it functions. And this is the key thing. It functions as a whole entity because it's recording my voice. So all those parts have to come together and function together to be able to record my voice. So obviously, at some level, the whole thing is there. But if I only imagine that there's one entity and no parts, I'm wrong. But if I imagine that there's one entity with parts, then I'm right. Right? So this is the distinction between what's to be rejected and what's not to be rejected. Okay. Everything, to use the technical language, arises independence upon causes and conditions. Everything arises in dependence upon causes and conditions, which means there's nothing that's uncaused. Everything exists because things came together to make it exist. Back to the independent circuit recorder. This exists because, you know, a bunch of people in China took a bunch of pieces and screwed them together and clamped them together, and other people ran presses, you know, to produce parts of plastic and, you know, integrated circuits and so on and so forth, and other people put it in a cargo container and shipped it across, you know, the ocean. And I mean, all of this stuff came together for it to be here. Those are all causes and conditions for it to be here. You know, there's some money that had to exchange hands, there were bookkeepers, banks. All this stuff is implicated in this thing being here. And if any of those things weren't there, this wouldn't be here. So we don't see that. So we see it as just here, as if it's independent. So the entity as being independent is what's to be refuted. That the entity is here is not to be refuted. What's to be refuted is that it's here independently. What's true is that it's here dependently. Right? Dependence is true. Independence is false. That's what's to be refuted. Okay, so now we've identified two general categories of things to be refuted and two general categories of things not to be refuted. The third thing is the label. Now, naively, when I look at this, I might say, oh, independent circuit recorder, or excuse me, not independent circuit recorder, no. Integrated circuit recorder, IC recorder. It takes a while, okay? Well, but IC recorder is not something that inheres in this little box. This is a concept that I place on it, and what's obvious that it's a concept I place on it, but is not inherent in this, is I can call it all kinds of things besides IC recorder. You know, it's an integrated circuit recorder. I've also called it a tape recorder. There's not one iota of tape in there, not a single moving part, you know. And not only that, at what point would I determine that this is an IC recorder and what point is not an IC recorder? I mean, there's this cord that goes out here to the wall. So does the IC recorder stop at this little juncture where the cord meets the, you know, the box, and the cord and the transformer is not part of the IC recorder? Or is that part of the IC recorder? I mean, people might answer that in different ways. I mean, if an IC recorder is defined as something which records my voice, and it's not plugged into the wall, it's not recording my voice anymore, right? So then it's not an IC recorder? So then that means that the cable is part of the IC recorder. I mean, you know, you can split hairs in all sorts of different ways, but from the Buddhist point of view, what's important is simply the understanding that the name and characteristics of the IC recorder come from my side, not from the side of the box. Now, again, that's kind of a trivial example, but there are examples that are very non-trivial, like self, subjective self, I. This is, again, where we get into the non-trivial environment. Because if we take this example that I've been using and start asking what is to be refuted and what is not to be refuted about I, then it gets really interesting, right? So if you say what is to be refuted about I is that I'm independent, what is not to be refuted is that I'm dependent on causes and conditions, there's something to be learned in that. Because I go through my life on the assumption that I'm totally independent. That's called developing a good, strong ego, but in psychoanalytic terms. But the fact of the matter is that no matter how strong my ego is, I'm totally dependent. We went through this example 2 weeks ago when I talked about the Second World War. That I'm here is because I was born in 1946. That I was born in 1946 is a result of the fact that my father, who was literally in transit between Europe and Japan when the Japanese surrendered, was demobilized almost instantaneously. And if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have been born in 1946. So if I wasn't born in 1946, is the person who would have been born eventually, would that have been me or somebody else? I mean, you can't even answer those kinds of questions. But the point is, here's this whole universe of causes and conditions upon which my existence now is totally dependent. But I don't go through life thinking about that. But it's true. So independence is to be refuted. Dependence is not to be refuted. So does that mean the self is being refuted? No. It means the independent self is being refuted in Buddhism, not the dependent self. So there's the important distinction. Okay. Parts and wholes. All right. Am I made up of parts or am I a whole? Well, what's to be refuted is that the self is a whole without parts. What's not to be refuted is that the self is a whole made up out of parts, because that's the truth. We all have sub-parts of our sub-personality. If you follow the Buddhist analysis, we're made up of the five heaps of the five skandhas. We're made up of perceptions, sensations, consciousness, body, all this kind of stuff. So that's not to be refuted. That's true. But that I'm a whole not made up out of parts, that is to be refuted, because that's false. Okay. Designation. Okay. Every minute of every day, I'm walking around, and there's this little narrative going on in my head about David this, that, and the other thing, right? David's hungry and he wants eggs for breakfast. David stubbed his toe. David has to go and get some flip-flops because his feet hurt. There's all this kind of stuff going on all the time, right? So, what part of that is true and what part of that is not true? Well, there's a David, but there's a David as a label for this whole complicated thing that's going on. There's not a little David like a little golden man someplace. If I look really closely, look in the right valve of my heart, I'm going to find that little David sitting in there. That's not going to happen. There's no little David in there, right? So what's to be refuted? Well, what's to be refuted is the notion that there's a real David rather than what's not to be refuted. This David is a label that's applied to this whole complicated thing that's going on, which is sitting here talking to you, okay? So this then is sort of the line of analysis that Buddhists want to follow. And the reason they want to follow this line of analysis is because, what's the source of being in a pickle? The source of being in the pickle is having a certain attitude toward the fact that I really am dependent. This gets tricky. That I really am dependent because I want to see myself as being independent. What's the problem with seeing myself as being independent? I do all kinds of stupid stuff as soon as I start seeing myself as being independent. Simple stuff like, I don't appreciate my wife enough. Truly, when you see yourself as being utterly independent of the people around you, you don't appreciate them anymore. When you see yourself truly as being dependent on the people around you, and I don't mean like, a cripple being dependent, but I mean like on a moment-by-moment basis, we're constantly interacting with each other in our lives, and our happiness, our nurturance, our clean house, whatever, is dependent upon this other person on a moment-by-moment basis. Then we have a different kind of relationship with them. But our minds constantly go to, I am independent. That's the fundamental fiction. But the fundamental reality is, no, I'm dependent. Very obvious for a child, less obvious for, an adult person, but it's true. Same with parts and everything else. So this then is the challenge, identifying what's to be refuted and what's not to be refuted. And where it leads to is a complicated and interesting state of mind. And I'll close with this, and then we'll pick up with it in 2 weeks, because it's an important metaphor, and it comes out of one of the great commentators of Buddhist thought. But this would be something just to contemplate for the next 2 weeks. So imagine that you're that it's summertime, and you're driving on Highway 66 or whatever is down there now. I guess it's not 66 anymore. Whatever the highway is, it's going across the Mojave Desert. What is that? I don't remember what highway number it is anymore. Anyhow, you're driving across the Mojave Desert in the summer between Las Vegas and Los Angeles. And you look out in the highway and you see a lake in front of you. Well, wait, there's no lake there. It's a mirage, right? So you look at the mirage. It's heat waves rising up off of the asphalt or the concrete. It makes it look like there's a lake there. You look at the mirage, and if you think, oh my goodness, I better hit the brakes because I don't want to drive into all that water, you've made a pretty big mistake, right? There's no water there that you have to avoid. In fact, a dangerous mistake, because you're going to get tail-ended, which is kind of an interesting aspect of the metaphor. Yeah. Now, well, but it's true in terms of, like, when you make mistakes about things, there are dire consequences sometimes. Yeah, okay. So, I mean, Chandrakirti didn't go that route with his metaphor, because he was living in whatever it was, the 6th century in India, so he didn't have to worry about getting tail-ended by another car. But here's the thing. If you look at the mirage and you think lake, you're wrong. That's to be rejected. When you look at that phenomenon and you think lake, that idea is to be rejected. If you look at mirage and you think mirage, that idea is not to be rejected. Right? Okay. Now, if you think of that as a metaphor for everything that exists in the world, yourself and everything else, there's what is definitely not there, which is the lake, and what is conventionally there, which is the mirage. The question is, what do you think about that mirage? I mean, if you think it's a lake, you're definitely just wrong. By ordinary conventional terms, simply wrong. It's not a lake. But if you look at the mirage and you think, oh, that is a mirage, then you're right. It's a real mirage, but it's a false lake. Okay. So if you take the mirage as a metaphor for what we see around us all the time, we look at things and our mind naturally goes to, it's independent, it's whole, it's exactly the way it appears without my concepts making it look that way. That's the mirage. The question is, do we take it for a lake? Do we take it for a mirage? If you can walk through life saying, wow, this is really a cool mirage, you know, I'm having a really ecstatic experience of a great mirage sunset. It's beautiful. Of course, it's a complete fantasy, but it's still beautiful. Then you're kind of lining up with a Buddhist way of thinking about things. Because it's not like the sunset isn't there. It's just not there the way you think it is. But it's very hard on a moment-by-moment basis to walk around thinking, my mind is playing tricks on me. But that's actually a prescription. And to say that the sunset isn't there is to reject what is not to be rejected, because the sunset is there. But to say that the sunset is there exactly as it appears to me is a mistake. There is something in that idea which is to be rejected. It's not as it appears. It's something other than that. And that's the delicate balance about the subjective self that Buddhists are asking us to deal with, Buddhist philosophers are asking us to deal with, and that we deal with in meditation. Because one of the things that we do in meditation, So I am going to add one other thing to this. One of the things that we do in meditation is we use that ability to designate the label David or I onto this body-mind complex, and we say, well, let's play with that. What happens if I designate David onto the image of green Tara? What happens if I designate David onto the image of Shakyamuni? What happens if I designate David onto the image of whatever? You can do that, because if David is just a designation on this complex, then David can be designated on anything. And then what happens when you do that? The rigidity with which you hold yourself as being me is slowly softened and broken and opened up, right, in a very practical way. I mean, obviously, on, you know, on the physical level, I'm not green Tara. I'm not a woman, and I'm not green, okay? But what happens if I really strongly focus in my meditation on I'm a green woman? Not only am I a green woman, I'm made out of light. Okay, so then the rigidity with which I hold me softens and becomes malleable. And I begin to see the sort of way in which it's both true and not true. I mean, I am David, sort of. And that sort of becomes easier to see the sort ofness. Right? And then, you know, what happens? Well, all my notions about me and I'm this, I'm that, you know, I'm great, I'm a slouch, whatever. All that kind of stuff, you can start relating to it differently. Doesn't mean you're instantly free of all that stuff. But you start developing degrees of increased freedom because you start playing with the hard way in which I is stuck onto your body-mind. And ultimately, it's useful because one thing we know for sure is our body-minds come to an end. And that's, for most people, pretty terrifying stuff. So one of the things that happens in this is we begin to prepare ourselves for relating to that phenomenon in a different way. So I'm not saying I'm not afraid of dying. I'm sure I am. Every time I get really sick and I think things are in a serious state of affairs, I know the truth of that matter. But still, there's other stuff going on, you know, and it's not quite as rigid as it might have. And for people who practice deeply and with real success, one can see how it might be very different. So I'll leave it at that.